My guest today, Stan Freberg, is a satirical writer. He's applied his talent to radio, cartoons, comedy records, and advertising. He got his start in show business doing voices for Warner Brothers cartoons fresh out of high school and played bit parts for Jack Benny's radio show. His comedy records have featured parodies of 50s and 60s songs, including Day-O and Heartbreak Hotel. He spoofed radio soap operas with his steamy John and Marcia routine in which he performed both roles. Freberg's offbeat humor on recordings attracted an imaginative advertiser who urged Freberg to write some commercials. Some of them are now classics, including his ad for Sunsweet Prunes, Today the Pits, Tomorrow the Wrinkles, and his 9 out of 10 doctors prefer Chungking Foods. Stan Freberg says he was born between the NBC chimes and a Rinso commercial as a Leo, with Lever Brothers his rising sign. He kept his ear close to his old Atwater Kent radio as a boy, and he wrote, produced, and starred in his own high school productions. He still writes and produces his own commercials. Today, his ad firm boasts the motto, Ars Gratia Pecuniae, Art for Money's Sake. Freberg's new autobiography is called It Only Hurts When I Laugh, which covers his career up to the early 60s. He told me how he first swept into the advertising racket from his comedy work.
Oh, I had an entire other career for many years. Before I ever came, you know, within 1,000 miles of Madison Avenue. That's right. The man that hired me was a fan of the records that I'd made, and, you know, I'd sold millions of records on Capitol, had a radio show on the CBS radio network, etc. And this man who was in San Francisco wanted some commercials that he thought, where he thought humor might work, and there was so little humor in advertising as to not even be noticed. And that was like the ice age of humor in advertising. There wasn't any, really. And so he liked the way I used humor for the ear, which, of course, was radio. And records was radio. Radio and records are interchangeable to me because they're all created for the medium of the ear and therefore the theater of the mind. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I did, fortunately, it worked at the point of sale, and I was hailed as some kind of new hero in certain quarters. Other quarters wrote me off as a nut, and they thought the whole thing was a fluke that could never happen again.
This was an ad for Contadina tomato paste.
Right.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
Could you explain a bit about what was going on at that time in the tomato paste industry and why they sought you out?
Yeah, in the tomato paste biz,
yeah.
Yes. Well, the Hunt's company, had suddenly the giant Hunt's people had invaded this very private, vertical, narrow field of a loyal following of Italian people, as well as other people who like to make tomato sauce and spaghetti. And the Contadina family panicked. Actually, it was the Morisi family who owned it, and they didn't know what to do. So they had this agency, Cunningham & Walsh, in San Francisco. And this man, Howard Gossage, was a fan, said, do whatever you want. And I said, well, I don't want to do normal advertising. I'm not interested unless I can do it my way, because I thought for years that I wish somebody would create advertising for me the way I, you know, wish they would. So now I would now be able to create advertising for other people the way I wished other people had created it for me. Since I was the consumer I knew best, I created it mainly for myself, which is the only true position that any artist can take. I have on my desk at home a little saying that by E.B. White that says that the true writer plays to an audience of one.
So you came up with a slogan then?
Well, it was more than a slogan. It was a jingle that went, who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? You know who, you know who, you know who. No mention of the client. The long, embarrassing pause, and the announcer said, in case you don't, it's Contadina tomato paste. But then I did this other commercial that led into that. And do we have time for me to recreate it
mm-hmm.
Out of my memory pen? We'll hope for the best here. It was the two men standing on top of the Empire State Building. And I played the older man. I said, all right, you got it straight what we want you to do now? The man said, I think so. You want me to take down this tower here on top of the Empire State Building, put up a 500-foot can of Contadina tomato paste? The man said, that's right. And the guy says, But that tower was put there to moor Zeppelins, too. I mean, I said, look, how many Zeppelins have moored there in the last week? He says, well, not too many, that's right. He says, I know, but well, I could be arrested. He says, all right, do you want me to get another contractor? Is that? He says, no, go ahead. He says, all right, now don't forget to have the can blink day and night. The words, there are many delicious uses for Contadina tomato paste. The man says, I thought you wanted it to blink. Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? I said, yeah. I said, well, which do you want? I said, well, let me sleep on it, okay? Okay. That was it.
And the clients, most of them, hated it.
They all, yes. The agency hated it, followed by the people at the marketing level of the client hated it because it didn't sound like real advertising. It sounded like some strange little off-the-wall conversation, entertainment, you know. But the president of Contadina, Marty Morisi, loved it. Years later, after it worked to an alarming degree, he said, it didn't sound like real advertising to me. That's what I liked about it. And I figured that everybody was up to their earlobes in real advertising, so if I created something that didn't sound like advertising, I might have a chance to communicate. That was my theory, and I proved it almost immediately, and I've been doing it ever since that year, which is 1956.
My guest is Stan Freberg. Your entrance into advertising was in some ways a fluke. Some guy liked what you were doing, thought it was funny, thought it would work. In many ways, your whole approach into the world of advertising and radio was in part a fluke, but in part also a result of skill. I mean, you took the bus into Hollywood one day looking for some work and thought you'd get off right in the middle of Hollywood and get a job, which, of course, is what a lot of people think they can do, but you did it.
Well, this is the first time I ever took the bus into Hollywood by myself. I was only barely 18 years old. This is right after I graduated from high school, and you're right, it was an amazing thing. And, you know, maybe God led me into this strange old building, and I saw a talent agent, the stars of tomorrow, you know. I walked in and auditioned for these people, and the woman immediately picked up the phone and dialed a man at Warner Brothers Cartoons, arranged an audition for me the next day. I went in, did a lot of voices. You know, this is just having come in on the bus again. And now this man says, terrific, can you come back tomorrow and do this for some of our directors? And so I go back home to Pasadena on the bus, lay awake all night, you know, while visions of Looney Tunes danced in my head, you know.
What were the voices you did for your audition?
Oh, all kinds of things. I did Franklin Roosevelt, you know, yesterday, December 7th, a date that will live in infamy. No, okay, then I did. Everybody wants to get into the act, you know, Jimmy Durante. And Peter Lorre, I did voices like that. I did kind of strange voice like that, you know. Anyhow, I auditioned for all these directors. We're on the other side of this black curtain, and I'm back there trembling in my shoes at a mic. Finally, this nice gentleman named John Burton, who ran Warner Brothers Cartoons for Leon Schlesinger, led me out and introduced me to all these guys, and they all came up. They were really nice, sweet to me. Chuck Jones put his arm around me and said, I'll figure out a way to use you. And he, of course, was one of the fathers of Bugs Bunny. And the Roadrunner, mainly the Coyote and the Roadrunner. And Bob Clampett came up and said, I just decided to have this little Scotty dog in a new cartoon talk like FDR, so I'll have you do Roosevelt.
I understand that you had to get special permission from the White House to do FDR's voice.
You did, that's right. In those days, anybody impersonating Roosevelt had a right to the White House or send a tape. We sent an acetate disc, their magnetic recording tape having not been invented yet. The Germans had invented, but we hadn't figured that out yet. And the Germans invented wire recorders also. But we'll discuss that on another special on the history of recording devices.
But the recording devices were something that fascinated you. I mean, you had a great deal of fun with the technology in making a lot of your parody records. And I'd like to play just a bit of one now that was inspired by Elvis Presley.
Thank you.
Well, since my baby left me, when I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, Heartbreak Hotel. Well, I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely, I could die. Could I have a little more echo on my voice? Oh, it's always crowded, that's got it.
I love that, to have a little more echo on your voice.
A little more echo on my voice, yeah. I, of course, was kidding around with the fact that Elvis did have a lot of echo, and it helped create his audio persona, you know. And he had a little problem when he went out and did personals because he didn't have a built-in echo chamber yet. That technology was to come later on. So rock stars now, they you know, it comes in a little box. You can just have any echo. You don't have to go into a giant echo room. But the way he moved his hips around, nobody noticed whether he had echo or not, and everybody was screaming so loud they couldn't have heard it if he had it when he did live appearances. You know.
The orchestra that you often worked with on some of your parody records, Billy May and his orchestra, had some fine studio musicians in it. And I understand some of the musicians you worked with include Laurent Almeida and a young Glenn Campbell.
Yeah, young Glenn Campbell's right. He played 12-string guitar on number of records, especially the Banana Boat song, Day-O, that I did. And he was a quiet, shy kid with long blonde hair, and he was yet to be discovered, but he was a terrific 12-string guitar player. My gosh, he was great. And Lorenzo Almeida was a marvelous classical guitarist who had his own recording contract with Capitol. He was like Segovia, you know. And so I used him on the Banana Boat song, too. My contractor, who was a woman named Dopey Klein.
This was the woman who put together your studio musicians.
Yeah, she would call various people, and the first time I used Glenn Campbell, she said, I got a new guitar player for you. This plays terrific 12-string. His name is Glenn Campbell. You're going to like him. And then she said, I couldn't find a rhythm guitar player that I'm happy with, so I got you Lorenzo Almeida. I said, are you kidding? He wouldn't work on a record of mine. The man is a classical. She said, oh, he's a big fan of yours. He thought he'd have the time of his life, and he did, and that was the Banana Boat session.
I remember a commercial that you worked on in the 1970s for the McGovern-Hatfield bill that would have cut off all funding to Southeast Asia to try to end the war in Vietnam. Was that, you know, for you, one of the first examples of issue-oriented campaign spot?
Yeah, that's probably the only issue-oriented campaign that I ever did. I've never done any political advertising, and I think that basically satirists ought to stay not apolitical, but certainly bipartisan, and stand in the middle and swing both ways, you know. My friend Mort Saul got into trouble one time because the Kennedys thought that simply because he had attacked, or not attacked, but made jokes about the Eisenhower administration, that he surely would only continue to throw barbs at Republicans, and then they were quite surprised when he began making jokes on the Kennedy administration.
Equal opportunity jokester.
Yes, that's what he was. But Mort claims he fell from favor for a while with Jack Kennedy. But in the end, though, they were all friendly, I guess. But this, the McGovern-Hatfield, I'm amazed that you remember that, because I did not write about that in this book. I'm saving that for the next book. I'm going to tell the whole inside story about that, which will be quite a revealing and astonishing story.
Well, I remember that, weren't you broken in by the plumbers at the time, the sort of the Nixon plumbers?
Yeah, that's right, yes. But I'd rather not talk any more about that at this time. For one thing, I'd like to get out of Washington alive. And
oh, come on. You can say things on radio that don't have to yet appear in print.
No, yeah, that's right. No, I was broken into. How do you happen to know about that, Sedge?
We have a very fine research staff here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I remember some of these also from the time.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. They have a very fine tap into my phone at home in Beverly Hills.
No phone taps. No phone taps. All public information.
It is public information, but I mean, I haven't really gone on official record about that, but I will talk about that in the next book. Yeah.
Which you expect out when?
A little over a year it'll be out. It's in my word processor now, a little over half done. And you see, the reason I didn't talk about it in this book is I did that in 1970 or 71, I think it was, 71 perhaps. And that was when McGovern and Hatfield were trying to legislate us out of Vietnam. The Congress would have cut off all funding to Southeast Asia. And when the money stopped, man, the war would have stopped. That would have been it. And we just missed by about three votes, three more senatorial votes, and we would have been out of there. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I did these spots, which were funded by public money. I donated my time, by the way. They paid for the production of it is all.
What sort of arrangements do you ask for when somebody says, we'd like to hire you?
Well, I'd rather not discuss my fee, but it's not paltry. But I've often said that when people ask, well, how much it costs to hire you, I say, more than you think, but not as much as you might imagine.
How about conditions? Are people then required? You give them a campaign and they have to take that?
First of all, let me tell you this. I don't take on everybody that comes to me. I fortunately, God willing, I've been able to be kind of selective now at this point in my career. And so if the thing interests me, if it's a terrible product, I wouldn't take it on for money in a Swiss bank account. So I have to believe in the product more or less. And then I have to be challenged by some problem that exists. You know, I turned down the Tide account for Procter & Gamble one time because they said, well, we can articulate our problem. And they were in my office in Hollywood, and they said, here's our problem. We have 72% of the detergent market, and we'd like to increase our share of market. I said, no, good, piggy. There's enough detergent backing up in the sinks and bathrooms of America, you know. But assuming that I like the product, I want to help them, then they pay me X dollars in front to address this problem, and then at some point I now read them the script, if they like it, which they usually do, maybe a couple small minor changes for technically correct lines, and then we go forward into production, and that's it. And then they pay the production and the rest of my fee. And the only requirement is that I shall decide what is or what is not funny. I finally wrote that clause in after years of being sick of explaining to clients what was funny about certain things. That if you have to explain it, you know, a guy with the Salada Tea Company in Boston, Massachusetts, said to me, can you change chicken soup to something else? I said, no, I can't. He said, well, what's funny about chicken soup? I said, if you have to ask, you'll never understand. It's just funny. Chicken soup is funny.
My guest is Stan Freberg here on Fresh Air. A couple of your most successful commercials, and in fact one of your parody records, on your This Is Stan Freberg Presents the USA record, you had a song called Take an Indian to Lunch.
Yeah.
Which was poking fun of wishy-washy liberals at the time.
Yeah, you also stuffed shirt liberals stuffed is shirt the way liberals.
And about. Your advertisement for Chungking Chinese food said 9 out of 10 doctors recommend, and you see a shot of 9 Oriental doctors and 1 Caucasian. Is this nowadays, would you feel that these ads might be verging into racist in subject, or would you tend to shy away from ethnic use in your ads?
No, not at all, not at all, because I certainly wasn't making fun of any ethnic race. I mean, that 9 out of 10 doctors recommend Chungking Chow Mein. If there's any, and 9 out of the 10 doctors are Chinese in their white coats and stethoscopes, if there are any Chinese people that don't think that's funny, they'll have to go to bed without any egg rolls. I'm sorry.
I understand that Jack Parr quizzed you once about the Take an Indian to Lunch and wondered whether you ever had, and you invited any Indian who was watching to show up for lunch with you the next day?
Right into the camera. I said on The Tonight Show, any Indians within the sound of my voice, come to my hotel tomorrow and I'll take you to lunch. And he said, which hotel? And I said, appropriately, the Algonquin. And the next day, 26 Indians showed up and cheered as I entered the lobby. Some of them were in ceremonial costumes, and one woman had a papoose on her back and a little carrying thing, and it was great. And so then we all walked like some kind of a protest march toward the elegant Rose Room, and I yelled in a loud voice, table for 27, you know. and the man at the maitre d' was a very crabby guy in a tuxedo, and he thought, what kind of a wacko Indian march is this now? This is the 60s, you know, coming in off the street into my rose room, not a chance. And so he mumbles, reservation? I said, no, they're not all from reservations. You know, some of them just live around Manhattan here. Anyhow, many years later, in 1985, I sang Take an Indian to Lunch this week in the Opera House of the Kennedy Center. It was a black tie affair with all the Indian tribes represented, and they were. It was all the Indian leaders of America, and Mrs. Reagan was there, and quite a lot of people. You know, first nighters from Washington. It was a lovely evening, and Martin Sheen introduced me, and Lauren Green played the other part. And anyhow, at rehearsal, this Indian trombone player came up out of the orchestra pit and said, "Mr. Freeberg, I'm Chief Russell Moore. You probably don't remember me, but 21 years ago, you took me to lunch at the Algonquin." And then he said, "You remember that little papoose on my wife's back? Here's what he looks like now." And he pulled out this beautiful picture of this young American Indian soldier, sergeant in the Army.
Nice story. Nice story. One of the times that I push my remote control button is one of these when one of these soppy ads come on, one of these heartwarming ads that has very soft light, sort of a star filter on it, sort of a Vangelis kind of music score, and it turns out to be for a wine or a phone company. are you ever going to do a parody of one of these soppy heartwarming ads that's now out and around?
Possibly.
Have you been thinking about it actively? Or?
Not actively, but, you know, I mean, I once, I've done a few parodies of soap operas. John and Marshall was a parody of soap operas, my record. And then for the Kaiser Aluminum Foil Company, I once did a parody of the soap opera genre, and it was called Kaiser Aluminum Foil Salesman Faces Life. And this poor man couldn't feed or clothe his family because the mean old grocer wouldn't stock Henry Kaiser's aluminum foil. And that went on every week. The episode would change, and I had Jim Amici as the announcer, who was Don Amici's brother. He was the most famous soap opera announcer in the 50s. And but I know exactly what you're talking about. I think probably it's time for me to do something like that.
Well, I'll look forward to it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I want to ask you about the sound effects men that you had on your records, and
yeah.
They both worked for Jack Benny, Bill James and Gene Twombly.
Yeah, well, that's right. I used a number of sound men, but those are the guys that I used quite a lot. And Bill James was from Gunsmoke. And when I did my CBS radio series, I inherited Bill James from Gunsmoke and Gene Twombly from the Jack Benny show. And he was just a footstep expert, and he taught me how to walk, really. You know, by the time I was doing that show in 1957, I had pretty good mic technique and from having worked in radio and so forth, and I was not a bad sound effects man, but this man was a virtuoso, and he taught me how to walk like one man and two men and actually three men, and I can do that now. I can also walk like a woman and walk like a teenager.
are these just technical effects, or is it in the style of what would use for the sound effects for the shoe sounds?
What would I use for the shoe sounds? Mm-hmm. I sit there in the studio late at night after most of the people have gone home and nobody there but my wife in the booth, who is my producer, and pull on these 12D Bally boots with hard leather heels that I used only for walking. And I find the proper surface, usually like a hard floor. Linoleum is okay, and sometimes I put down a board of masonite. But I walk on marble or whatever. And we put the mic down there. I still like to work on the 44B, the diamond shaped mic. But the Sennheiser, whatever. I get it down there, and I just walk, and that's it. I walk on, so you don't have to fade me on and off. I can walk on mic and walk off, and it's just it'd be easier if I could put my boots on now and show you what I mean. But on this book tour, I don't have my boots with me. But anyhow, every time I put them on, I think about Gene Twombly and how he taught me how to do this. Also, I can run up up and down stairs, even though I'm just walking on a flat surface.
Your father was a minister. Do you feel that you're also in a similar calling? You have a public pulpit?
Yes, I actually do. I always thanked my dad for not forcing me into the traditional forms of ministering, but when you can make people laugh and not take themselves so seriously, you are indeed helping them get through life, and according to my friend Norman Cousins, you are in fact helping to heal them. And do you know about the book that Norman Cousins wrote healing himself?
Yeah. So why for you does it only hurt when you laugh?
Why is that the title of my book?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's an old joke, actually, and I can't remember whether it's my joke or not, but in 1956, I wrote an article for Collier's Magazine, and that was the title of an article I wrote that they had asked me to write on censorship, and I talked a lot about the problems I'd had with the lawyers at Capitol Records and the censors on radio and so forth, and the joke actually went, there's a man standing there with a spear through him, and some said, that must be terrible for you. And he said, no, actually, it only hurts when I laugh, you know. Not much of a joke, but it occurred to me that when I laughed is when I frequently got into trouble with censorship and lawyers, later on in advertising, clients, people trying to get me not to do something that I felt I wanted to do and needed to do in order to communicate with people.
Well, I want to thank you very much for plunging ahead with all that.
Well,
anyway,
I'm resilient. I'm resilient, man. I'm a survivor. The way I feel, I haven't even started yet with the things that I want to do.